It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're bringing you a very special and unusual episode, something we've never tried before, which is we are recording live in front of an audience at the Taproot on Spinard Road. It's Be There or Be Square. So if you're listening to it on the radio and you weren't here, big mistake. I thought for today's show that we would do something that really goes to the name of our show, which is talk to some real explorers. And I've got a couple of guests who have done exploring around Alaska in a lot of different ways and have had a lot of amazing experiences and are still doing explorations, which is really a huge part of why we all love the outdoors, right? Is to find new places that we haven't been before and that maybe nobody's been, and to see what they're like and have that sense of adventure. So I want to introduce them right now. Luke Mell, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Yeah. And Nancy Pfeiffer.
Thanks.
So, Nancy, you're getting ready to take off for a trip in Southeast Alaska very shortly, where you're going to be paddling and kind of living off the land. And I thought that was such a cool, interesting way to do what you're doing, right? It's not like mountain house packets, right? So tell us about what you're up to.
Two summers ago, my husband and I took off on a two-week, we call it subsistence kayaking trip in Prince William Sound. Last summer we did it for a month, and it worked out really well. We hope to be eating shrimp and crab and halibut and silver salmon, and sometimes we eat a lot of pink salmon and beach greens and things like that. But it's a really different way of relating to the land. We don't make a lot of miles, probably 10 miles every day or two.
There's always something to eat out there, right? I mean, beach greens are these, like, they're a little bit salty, but they're kind of like salad, and they're almost everywhere, and you can always eat mussels, and you can always find something to eat.
Yeah, we told my friend Paul Twardock that, we were going to go do this, and we said, well, you'd have to be an idiot to starve to death in Prince William Sound in August, and then we had to go prove up on that.
Right.
We would not starve to death in Prince William Sound in August.
Yeah, you're not only not starved to death, you'd be eating seafood the whole time. It would be fabulous. Yeah. Cool. So, Luke, and you just came back from a trip kind of in that part of the world, but, like, at a different elevation, like going from Haines to Juneau. Tell us about, and you just finished that trip, right?
Yeah, we got back last weekend.
Yeah, tell us what you did.
We did not eat any seafood or anything else harvested, and we ate a lot of Mountain House. I'm actually a huge fan of the Mountain House Pro Packs.
Yeah.
I think I ate about 50 a year.
So what was the trip?
It was kind of secondary to the Pro Packs. The key is that... So we've been doing ski traverses that have extended from Mount Iliamna and had at this point ended in Haines, so different segments each year, a couple hundred miles a year. So this year we pushed it further southeast by starting at Haines Pass and skiing to Skagway, resupplying there, and then continuing to Juneau. So we were up on the glaciers the whole time.
And a lot of the trips you've done are just these sort of long traverses, like pick two spots and figure out how you can get from one to the other using bikes and pack rafts and skis and, like, whatever you need, right?
Exactly.
And with a lot of planning, yeah. Which I think of as real exploration, right? Because you don't know what you planned it, but you don't know exactly what you're going to run into.
Yeah, and this, the leg from Skagway to Juneau was kind of a reminder. I've kind of taken for granted the exploration part because all the other parts hadn't had a very defined route, and so we would do research and say, I wonder if this pass goes, and it would go, and that would feel rewarding. Uh-huh. And on this trip from Skagway to Juneau, that's a really established route because of the Juneau Ice Field Research Program, and one of our guys had done that route like 8 times, and so we'd say, oh, let's try this pass, and he'd be like, well, actually, if you go up here to this ridge, there's a snowfield, and it was a bummer.
Yeah. I hear
really
you.
Right. It took away from part of the appeal for me.
So, Nancy, you did something that I thought sounded so cool, and I bet the audience would really be interested in this, where you looked around, like, where are all the unknown abandoned hot springs around Alaska? Because there's a few that have, like, hotels, like, Circle Hot Springs and Chuna Hot Springs.
Yeah.
Just a few. But there's a lot of places where geothermal energy is coming to the surface, and you decided, like, let's go out and find them, right? And where did you find the information about where these places would be?
I originally would go to USGS over at APU and just rummage through their files.
Uh-huh.
And kind of the old school way. And yeah, there's 130 hot springs in Alaska, and so far I've ticked off about 30 of them.
Wow, that's probably more than anybody else.
And that's, yeah, you know, some of them are a couple of good 2 weeks in.
Wow, so tell me about like what one of these like fairly arduous journeys to get into one of these hot springs would be. Like, give us an example.
Fantastic one is on the Reed River. It's kind of, you can get to it from the Noatak in the Arctic up behind Mount Igikpak, or you can hike in from Walker Lake, or you can start in Bettles. You can start at the Hall Road. But it's, yeah, it's a good 2 week hike and float from probably any of those places.
Wow. So how do you plan a trip like that? Because you're going into place. I mean, there's no guidebook telling you like what it's like out there, right? It's sort of like, just take maps.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly maps. Mm-hmm. When I first started traveling in the Brooks Range, the 1 to 250s were the only maps available.
So it's now, a map, but it's like
now
pretty damn vague.
You know, yeah. Oh yeah. Well, the first time I came over the ridge, I was like, "Wow, that's a really big valley." Uh-huh. But yeah, now everything up there, I think, is mapped inch to the mile, and you know, like you use a lot of Google Earth. I don't know if this would show up there, but at the time, none of these hot springs were actually, or a lot of them weren't actually marked on the map, but you know, they were found or reported by miners and things like that.
Some prospector just stumbled upon it and put an X and.
Yeah, and then, you know, there's been a few government programs where they've sent people out to explore the geothermal potential, and they would write that up in a long scientific report.
Uh-huh.
And you would muddle through and find out, is it hot enough?
Uh-huh. So you get out there, and did you find any that were just awesome and you could have, like, an incredible soak?
Definitely.
Okay, is you going to reveal that to us, or is that a secret?
Which ones?
Yeah.
Well, there's 30 of them.
They're all great?
No. Some of them I bushwhacked 4.5 hours up rivers in southeast Alaska and found a muddy puddle.
That can be a little frustrating. But, I mean, that's all about exploring, because you don't know what you're going to find exactly,
uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah. And it's fun. It was, yeah.
So give us an example. Like, what was one of the very best ones when you got there?
There's one that I wasn't expecting that's on Lake Emmons out in the Aleutians between Cold Bay and Pavlov.
So it's on an island, like one of those uninhabited islands?
It's on the peninsula, but it's it's near the very end.
Oh, neat.
And we were headed over to Ski Pavlov, and you know, there was a hot springs reported there. And basically there was a corner of the lake that had a gravel bar that very aesthetically cut the warm part off from the cold part. And it was a perfectly built, as far as I could tell, natural pool.
So you could like take a soak and then jump in the cold water and jump back in the warm
water. Well, the cold water was frozen.
Oh. So you couldn't jump in.
The warm water was nice.
Theoretically, right. So Luke, have you found any on your, I mean, you've done like 20 of these traverses, and I know that you mentioned that you don't necessarily plan or lead them all. You have kind of a posse that goes with you, right?
Yeah, it's kind of like what you said about feeling uncomfortable with getting credit for the show.
Yeah.
I carry a 5-pound camera, and I get credit for a lot more than I deserve.
Because you've got a fantastic blog. I don't know if people have checked it out. Tell them what the URL is.
It's Things to Look At, like a play on Things to Look At, which is what my brother already has.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
In these traverses, have there been times when you found stuff that you absolutely didn't expect to find?
You know, not a lot. I mean, mostly it's landscape.
Because you plan it out.
Yeah. I mean, but we're not. I mean, what we discover are some views that maybe we didn't expect. Wow, that's an amazing view. Or I didn't think we'd be able to see Mount Logan from here or Fairweather from there. But the one thing that stands out that we didn't expect to find was like this 8-foot hot dog. Which was, they ran it in the paper a couple of years ago, and that was at the end of this Iliamna Redoubt Spur trip. And so coming down onto the Susitna mudflats, we saw something in the distance. And
so just to set the stage here, how far had you trekked before you found the hot dog?
Probably about 240 miles.
So 240 miles of sort of bushwhacking and working your way through open country.
Yeah, but it wasn't a hard trip. We had some food drops. People were leaving, and so the flight that would come in would bring food. So we weren't. On some of these trips, we are low on food. On that trip, we weren't. But we were still 3 weeks into.
No, that's three weeks. 3 weeks in the Alaska wilderness to find a styrofoam hot dog is like.
Yeah. And so Eben sees this rock from a distance and says, "Boy, it looks like a giant hot dog, ha, ha, ha." And, And we got closer, and it was a giant hot dog.
And what was the story behind it?
The story trickled through. This was pretty fun, actually. Through friends of friends and Facebook, and I got just little snippets, and eventually, and a guy, I did a volunteer thing for Healthy Futures on the Park Strip, and one of the other volunteers came up to me and kind of under his breath said, "I know something about that hot dog." And he'd been on a cross-country team, cross-country running team in high school, and had stolen it, part of a group that had stolen it from Miller's. It's past Wasilla, Miller's something. But they have a huge ice cream cone there now, styrofoam ice cream cone.
Oh, I see.
So you might expect to find that downriver at
somebody
some point.
Somebody stole it from the ocean, huh?
Somebody stole it and tied it up under the bridge in Palmer. And then it washed down. I got an email from a pilot that was flying for fire crews that had spotted it. And he had even found it on Google Earth imagery from like 2004. And so he sent me the imagery and time stamped it so I could see, there's the hot dog on the Matanuska River. And
wow.
Yeah, so
that's. So it's kind of a historic hot dog.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's been around.
And what did you do?
We lit it on fire.
Kind of a Viking funeral, like put an end to this thing, huh?
Yeah, we were carrying extra fuel, and I can't actually justify it. We just lit it on fire.
So now it's like gone. There's nobody.
No,
it didn't burn it up.
The smoke was so like noxious and black that I thought there's a lot of air traffic there.
Yeah.
I thought maybe that somebody would think we were signaling for help, which we were not. So we extinguished the fire.
So we could still find like a scorched hot dog now. Yeah. Well, the weenie roast, somebody left it in there a little too long. It's Outdoor Explorer. We are talking about exploring today. And we're in front of a live audience at the Taproot, who you may hear a chuckling in the background. I've got two great guests with me this evening who were willing to take the plunge on talking in front of a live audience, which is a little bit intimidating, I have to say myself. Luke Mell and Nancy Pfeiffer, and they've done tons of interesting things. So I want to talk for a minute about planning these trips, because I know you guys have kind of somewhat different approaches to that, about like how much detail you want, how planned out you want everything. And Nancy, you're getting ready for this trip, and you've done a lot of other trips. What's your philosophy? I've heard it said that if you can plan a lot and then just actually never get out the door, right? I mean, you can just sort of, if you're really worried about everything being perfect, you probably will never go anywhere, right? But you've gone a lot of places, so you must know when to stop planning.
Yeah, we're trying really hard right now to bust that move and get out the door.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, this one's a little different in that I've actually done sections of this trip before, mm-hmm. about 20 years ago. So I know more than I would on any other trip. And it's pretty known because it's on the ocean, and the ocean's kind of everybody's travel route.
Uh-huh.
So I'd say there's probably a lot more knowns.
Right, there's towns
maps,
around and stuff like that.
There's maps, tide tables, and current charts are major tools.
But when you did this Baffin Island trip, then you run into some stuff that you definitely didn't expect, or tell us about that one.
And
I set the scene for everybody.
So paddled Baffin Island from the old Frobisher Bay, trying to get to the town of Pangerton. The idea was
Give us the geography for those who don't know
what it is. Southern end, east coast of Baffin Island. Just always love the Arctic. It's the same latitude. I think this is really fascinating. It's the same latitude as Southeast Alaska, and it is like paddling through the Brooks Range. There is nothing on the ground taller than a quarter of an inch.
Wow.
So
that sounds spectacular.
Yeah.
So you can see a really long way.
Yeah. So that should have been my first hint, that the currents come up Greenland, across the north, and down the coast of Baffin Island. Mm. And the currents change everything, the vegetation and everything.
Huh.
What I didn't plan into that whole picture was that when those currents do that, they bring with them the polar bears. And the ice went out early that year. The ice is going out early every year. The polar bears swim ashore. All of this was known to biologists, but it wasn't known to me until after the trip. My poor research. When we got out there was about a polar bear per square mile. and we had polar bears in camp every night, and there was only two of us, and you know, you can't keep somebody up all night. We had a home-built electric fence that I had hobbled together that had a lot of slack in it, and basically it was probably the one place that's like, this place is so wild that if I stay here, I'm not going to make it. So. Yeah.
Well, the thing about polar bears is that, you know, black bears certainly will almost always run away, and brown bears are a little bit scarier, but polar bears will actually go and eat a person, you know. They,
I know.
It's like a meal, and they'll stalk people, and I can imagine that being just terrifying. So
it's
what do you just turn around and retreat at that point?
We let it go on a couple of nights.
Uh-huh.
We had a gun. I bought a gun and practiced with it. We had initially cracker shells, which go out about 25 feet and explode. And it was very much a conversation with this bear about how close she could get before I would shoot in her direction, and managed to stay her off long enough to get everything packed in the boat.
So the bear is pushing closer and you're backing it off.
Coming back,
pushing closer.
You know,
yeah,
15 minutes, 10 minutes, 5 minutes.
So there's no snow on the ground so you could see the bears.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had the experience when I was working on my book, The Whale and the Supercomputer, up in the Arctic, saw a ton of polar bears, and all of my stories seem to make me sound kind of dumb, but in any I was left, the guys who were whaling jumped in the Umiak and went chasing after a whale, and left me sitting there on the pack ice, and I was just sort of looking around, being sort of the dumb sort of visitor, and a native guy came up on his snow machine and sort of stood next to me and sort of like stood looking in the distance, just perfectly still, just like looking off in the distance. And I'm like, what's he doing? You know, is he like being a statue? What is he, you know? And then he says, oh, there's a polar bear over there about 100 yards. And I looked over and there was actually a polar bear that had been coming closer and closer. And I had not seen it because it's so well camouflaged against the white that the only way you can see it is if you keep looking in the same direction and don't like move your field of vision, then you'll see his nose and his eyes move. And I don't know what would have happened if that guy hadn't come along. Maybe everything would have been fine. But it was a kind of a crazy sort of thing, like in a very scary animal. Yeah. So Luke, in your planning, you take a really detailed approach. Tell us how you plan a trip.
Yeah, we'll spend a lot of time on the computer, looking at Google Earth or aerial imagery, whatever we can find, and contacting pilots, contacting friends, guides that might have been in the area, and collecting as much information as possible. I think that originated from planning for the Wilderness Classics, because the point on those is to be so efficient, to cover a lot of ground, so you really don't want to spend a lot of time with a map open thinking about this pass
right.
versus that
pass.
Well,
let's just make sure people know what the Wilderness Classics are, because that There are these races where, like, pick two spots in the map and see who can get between them fastest, right?
Exactly.
And you've done quite a few of them.
Yeah.
And you've won a number of them.
Yeah.
How many? Okay, I'll worm it out of you. How many have you won?
I think 5 of the winters and 2 of the summers.
Yeah. So that's an amazing accomplishment. A really, really very impressive. So
the coolest thing about the class.
Yeah.
The coolest thing for me with the classics is that it's the steepest learning curve I've ever experienced in anything, not just recreation, but in life. Like, I'll finish one of those trips and just be blown away. It'll take weeks for it to kind of sink in what I learned, what I'd change differently, and what I'd do differently. I'm really grateful to them for that process of learning. Is
because
awesome.
It feels like you're just thrown into sort of situations that you can't really... I mean, maybe you've planned it all out. Is that, I mean, those classics, how do you sort of, you've got to go across rivers, you've got to go through brush, you've got to go through all kinds of different things that you can't really anticipate to some degree.
Right, so we're not planning the route to that detail.
Uh-huh.
But I guess I meant more like, you hear that nobody brings a sleeping bag and a tent, and that sounds crazy your first year, but if nobody's bringing a slant, you know, nobody's bringing that equipment, then I'm not going to bring it either. And after that year, it's like, wow, yeah, that was no problem. I don't need a sleeping bag. So that's what I mean by the learning curve.
Huh.
Yeah.
How do you sleep?
You're that tired, you just sleep. It's so easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember that the first one I did it solo because I was nervous about team dynamic and slowing other people up. And so I curled up on this talus field and slept like a baby, you know, for 2 hours, whatever. And I woke up and they were like football sized rocks that I was sleeping on. And there's no way that would be, you couldn't even sit there if we went there now.
Yeah.
But being that tired, it was just like, oh, this is amazing.
Oh yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah. So I learned a ton through those experiences.
I bet you did. Yeah.
And about how to plan trips and probably most, the biggest lesson from those classics is that you'll go through a stage where you're moving less than a mile an hour and you're kind of calculating, I don't have enough food to keep this pace and their mood and you get concerned. And then things get better and all of a sudden you're moving at 5 miles an hour or in the winter, 8 miles an hour with a tailwind or something. And so that lesson that things always get better was huge. And then I could apply that to everything else.
So it's just sort of the psychological or the emotional way of getting through a bad situation.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. I think I've heard people call it kind of like old man strength, old man grit, you know, these old timers, and it's not just about men, but just this like mental grit.
Ability to get through a hardship. Yeah, that's what a lot of this is all about, right?
Yeah. Right, Nancy?
Yeah, no, that reminded me of, Knoll students I've had in Patagonia, and they have, you're having a rough time. And yeah, everything in their life will be easier than this at some point. And we would read to him out of Shackleton or, The Worst Journey in the World or something like that and put it all in perspective.
Yeah. Well, and it's something that people find it hard to understand, because why would you go out and put yourself in a situation that's uncomfortable and difficult? And it's not just about overcoming it. It's about sort of like getting through it and sort of what you learn from it, right?
I think so.
Yeah. So we keep getting away from planning. So tell us how you plan one of your traverses.
So I'll spend weeks or months, depending on the trip, on Google Earth and fine-tuning a line, or somebody else will, and they'll send it to me. And basically we'll have these digital files get passed around the team, and somebody will say, oh, I talked to a pilot that said that's actually really cracked up. And somebody else will say, oh, but look at this cool hot springs over here. Maybe we can tie that in. And then we'll take that route and put it on an iPhone that also has the imagery. And then we'll just pull out our phones on the trip and navigate by iPhone.
Do you take solar panels or something to keep the phone charged?
Depending on the length of the trip, but I can get a week on one charge. Huh. And so I'll take a page out of the gazetteer. That's been the paper map that I've been carrying.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's awesome because you cross a page of the gazetteer and it's like, all right, page,
that's
number 48 or whatever.
Yeah, another 120 to go, and you got the whole thing covered. Yeah,
I really like that.
So. When those Google satellite images are detailed enough for you to tell, like, this is a good spot or this is not a good spot, or does it? How do you sort of figure that out?
The resolution varies across the state, but it'll vary from being able to pick out game trails to not being able to pick out anything.
Uh-huh.
So it's hit or miss.
Huh. Wow. So, and you've done some of these traverses. You were mentioning to me on the phone this afternoon. Kind of over Denali, over Logan. You did one in Mexico. And you were talking about like the different modes of transportation you chose at Denali. I thought that was really interesting. Like you got bikes in there somehow.
Right.
And part of this is to avoid spending money on airplanes, right?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, the whole group of guys were all very frugal. And I think a lot of outdoor explorers are.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe the best, because it kind of forces you to be creative with where you start and where you finish. And so when we were looking at going up Denali, somebody looked, somebody got a quote for the price to fly into base camp, and we're like, wow, no, I can't afford that.
Yeah.
So then it started this month-long process of, well, how can we get in there without flying? Mm-hmm. And so we ended up biking with 10 friends. We had 10 friends come and help carry gear on the road, on the park road.
So you just bike, like where the tour buses are going by, you're biking?
But it was mid-May, so there wasn't any traffic. So we biked as a group of 14 as far as we could, and then the bikers turned back and we switched to our skis and skied up and over Denali.
How far did you make it on the bikes?
How far is that road?
Oh, right to the end of the road, to Wonder Lake?
No, not quite to Wonder Lake, maybe 10 or 15 miles short of Wonder Lake.
Huh. So you can go out there in May and bike it and not have dust. That sounds nice.
It was nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then you put on your skis.
Yeah.
And then what did you do? How
well,
far
first
did you
we ditched
one?
The bikes, and it was like literal. Like we just put them in the ditch.
You come back from later?
We had a friend of a friend that arranged to pick them up for us later.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then we put on our skis and skied up the Muldrow Glacier and got up on the summit and skied down.
How long does that take to go from the park road to the summit of Denali? I mean, that's kind of adding a level of difficulty, I think.
I think we made it to 16,000 feet in like 5 days.
We were
motoring, but we had all done a classic together. We'd all traveled. It was like the best shape I've been in. So we motored there, and then we got pinned by a storm for a week, and then we went up to the summit like a day later.
All right. And then the way down, you came down a different way, right?
Went down the standard west buttress route.
Ended up where?
A friend had flown in our pack rafts and buried them for us. So we
buried them under the ground?
And under the snow, yeah.
Under the snow, okay.
So we dug the pack rafts out and floated to Talkeetna to finish.
Ended up in Talkeetna. That is so cool.
It was super cool.
Yeah. And it seems like it's so much like more, I don't know, it's a better story than if you had just like flown in and landed on the Kahilna Glacier.
But it felt like we got to see the whole landscape build to Denali and then drop off again. It was awesome.
And you planned this all out with Google Maps and Google Earth.
Yeah, largely. Yeah.
Wow.
And when we pulled into Talkeetna, there was an older guy there walking this little poodle dog, and there was an RV nearby, so we just kind of assumed that he was with them. And he started asking us questions, and he said, "You guys just float in, you know, on the river," and he knew the river names. And we're like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Well, did you come down from Kahilna?" And we're like, "Yeah." And he said, "Did you come over Denali?" And we're like, it was like this tourist knew way too much. And it turned out it was Brian Okanek.
Oh, really? Okay.
It was not a tourist.
One of the most famous pilots up there. Yeah. So, Nancy, it sounds like you don't use all this tech. You're not a techie sort of outdoors person.
I would say no, yeah.
Yeah. And maybe you don't plan to that level of detail, or at what level of detail do you go when you're planning kind of a place that you've never been before?
I haven't planned to that kind of detail, though your Denali trip reminded me very much of my first Denali trip. I lived on Stampede Road. I traded my neighbor to haul our gear in with his dog sled. It cost us $300. A lot in common that way.
Where did you start from?
We did fly in with another friend with a plane who took it in for free. But we lived on the north side, and our gear started on our front porch. And
So how much do you want to know, or how much do you need to know before you go somewhere?
I want to know like what's legitimately out there. I don't feel like I want to protect myself from information that's out there. And there was a story where I was guiding in Patagonia. In Patagonia, there's a lot of places that legitimately don't have a map. It's called the SVE, the Area Sin Visibilidad, and there's no map for this place because they flew over it and there was clouds and they didn't get to map it.
That's kind of great, isn't it?
But we were told there was no map to this place.
Uh-huh.
We went and we got up there. We had kind of an epic. We came back down. We find that the guy living in the town at the base has a map of it. And I was like, I would have loved a map of that place.
So what happened because you didn't have a map?
I feel like if that information is there,
why not use it? Right. What happened because you didn't have a map?
Well, a lot of things happened.
Let's hear it.
One guy got hurt, a boulder the size of a table rolled onto his foot. Turned out it wasn't broken after the three-day swelling curve. He could walk out. And we got up there, and what had been kind of described to us as a flat snowfield was a bunch of spires. And so even if the guy's foot had not been hurt, we could not have crossed that. So we would have known before we started that this traverse was impossible if we'd had a map.
I wonder if there's anywhere in the world today that doesn't really have a map. I kind of doubt there is.
There's still some places in southern Patagonia that don't have a map, or they have Argentina has maps of them, but Chile doesn't.
Huh, neat. All right, well, we're going to take a quick break. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're hearing from Nancy Pfeiffer and Luke Mell, who are, as you can hear, are real outdoor explorers. I'm just a guy who asks about it. And we're in front of an audience at the Taproot. And so stick with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're at the Taproot doing our show live tonight. We've been bringing up some of our audience members to tell us their true and amazing stories of outdoor adventure. And right now, Daniel Cohn's with me. He's visiting from Colorado and just climbed Moose's Tooth up in the Alaska Range. Congratulations.
Thank you.
How was your climb?
It was interesting. I'm really happy we made it up there, but I feel like we got really lucky as well, and the conditions were changing rapidly. And I think we did a route called Ham and Eggs, which is sort of a more technical route. Our first day there, another party returned. Well, they kind of showed up when we did, and they had a really short time window and just kind of went and really quickly and had to turn back immediately because they encountered, you know, soft ice. But that whole afternoon, we were surrounded by avalanches on Bear's Tooth, on Moose's Tooth, and periodically, maybe every 20 or 30 minutes,
there would be
a serac or something that would collapse and come down.
Okay, this is starting to sound bad.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I know this might not reflect well on me, but we were pretty determined.
Okay, so you decided to go for it, huh?
Well, so eventually we worked at it all day, and we made it up to this ridge on the top of Moose's Tooth, and it was late at night, maybe 4, 3:30 in the morning, and it was dim, but we got this amazing view of Denali and Foraker, and decided to do what we call a shiver bivvy, where we didn't have full camping gear, and we just sat on the top of the ridge in our insulated clothing, and kind of stared at Denali for about 3 hours, and we had a stove.
That sounds pretty nice.
It was, yeah, it was really nice. That was one of the biggest rewards of the climb, mm-hmm. and kind of calming and beautiful, and, you know, like totally worth the trip and maybe worth the risk. That's kind of a personal judgment, I guess.
Yeah.
So from there, we continued to the summit, and it turned out to be another really warm day, that summit day. But then on the way down, rappelling down, and everything's going fine. And around those like really dicey cruxes in the middle of the route that were melting out, at one point my friend yelled, "Avalanche!" And you know, I was on the rope rappelling down, and fortunately, rocky sides, and I basically didn't feel too scared because I thought I could duck to cover, and I just went 2 feet over and had my head under a rock and, you know, brought my body in. And this avalanche, sure enough, like 40 seconds after he said it, he probably saw it way above, it came by and streamed by us, and I could have reached out and touched it, but I felt safe because I was under a rock. And it lasted, it probably lasted 30 seconds, and it was kind of this dense, heavy snow, and just passed, and pretty scary because we well could have been in its path. I mean, fortunately, we were attached to good anchors and ropes,
mm-hmm.
so if we held on long enough and we were in the middle of it, we might have been able to.
Yeah, I doubt it.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a slab avalanche.
Well, yeah. I'm glad you're still here, Daniel.
Thank you.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you, Daniel Cohn. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues at the Taproot. Welcome back. It's Outdoor Explorer at the Taproot. I'm Charles Wolforth, recording today's show live at the Taproot on Spinard Road, and some of our most avid fans are here, and I've got two real outdoor explorers to talk to and learn about their adventures and how they do it, and maybe give you some inspiration and ideas. Nancy Pfeiffer and Luke Mell, thanks for being here, you guys.
Thanks.
So you guys have both done some really cool stuff in the wintertime. And Nancy, I know you've done a lot of kiting. And when I see people do this, I think, like, that looks really, really hard. But you've done quite a bit of it, and you said it wasn't all that hard to learn when you first did your kite skiing. But tell us about like the first time you did it. Was it easy? Natural?
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy to learn. I actually had paraglided before that, but I took off with four of us, bought kites, and we took them out of the bag one time, flaked them out in a farm field, tried it out.
It's windy, you just hang onto it, boom, you start scooting along?
You're connected with a harness.
Okay.
And when you're on skis, yeah, you get pulled.
And how do you steer? Just like the way you would steer on the ski slope, or is something about the kite steering?
Yeah, the skiing is absolutely the same as skiing. So if you're already a skier, that part of it, you know.
And what kind of skis are you using?
I personally use a pretty beefy Telemark ski. Most people use Run-N-A skis.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, it works like a wing. It works like a sailboat, kind of. It's on really long strings that go quite a ways away from you. Four of us managed to buy kites, take them up on the Harding ice field, and, hike up the Harding. We used ropes and everything till we got up on the big flat part of the Harding. Spent a couple of days learning to kite, kiting around, playing in the little dips and hollows, and took off and kited to Homer.
Wow.
Took us about 10 days.
So how many miles can you cover doing that, as opposed to if you were just charging along on snowshoes? I mean, it's really fast, right?
Yeah, it's fast. You know, it depends on...
So you entered the ice field, what, from where?
From Seward.
Okay, so Seward to Homer. Well, that's pretty impressive, yeah.
Yeah, and exactly how many miles a day, I don't really
know.
Yeah,
don't worry
about it.
It
depends so much.
Huh?
You got tailwind or beam wind.
So what happens if the wind's going the wrong direction, you're just going to ski.
Yeah, I mean, you can tack to within probably 30 degrees of the wind. I notice it's radio and I keep using my hands. But
So just like a sailboat, you sort of work your way back and forth. Takes a bit longer, but...
It takes a lot longer, yeah. Sometimes longer than if you just put your head down and slogged.
What's the physical effort of doing that? I mean, are you like using all your muscles and really like a lot of effort to do it, or is it pretty easy and flowing?
Yes, but in a very different way than, you know, slogging and carrying a load, but it's a lot of static. I equate it to like skiing top to bottom on Alyeska without a break, the way your legs feel you're doing that, because that's what you're doing when you're kiting.
But all day. Yeah, so that does sound
You can still take breaks. But.
Yeah. So you did an Arctic trip too, right?
Yeah.
Tell us about that trip.
First Arctic trip, and my husband has learned to kite too. Same thing. I pretty much took him out there and hooked him up. And
off he went. Okay.
And our first trip was Okpilak Hot Springs on the north side of the Brooks Range. Tiketovik came in with a native friend on a snow machine and stayed at the hot springs there for a couple of days. It was cold. It was good 30 below. And it was April, but in this narrow valley, the sun comes up about 10:30 and sets about 3:30. I was like, oh, that's just like Palmer midwinter.
Yeah.
And then we, you know, after we got a ways away from the mountains, we started getting some wind, and it was just like the whole Brooks Range is turning pink behind us, and we're doing these big, arcing, beautiful, downhill cruising kind of turns. Just like I dreamed before I left on the trip it was going to be like.
Yeah. So. And there's no trees, so there's nothing, that's just open country. And,
you need wide open spaces.
And the snow is usually really hard there.
Yeah, sometimes it's pretty sastrugi.
Mm-hmm. And then sometimes they'll have these striations from the wind, you know, so I guess you'd have to watch out for that a little bit.
That's like bump runs.
So how long did that journey take you?
I think that was two weeks.
Wow.
In total.
That sounds...
We tend to take a long time.
That sounds fabulous. So did you said you did another Arctic trip.
Yeah, then the year after that was serpentine to Shishmaref, another hot springs out in the... on the Seward Peninsula. So from the village of Serpentine to the, from Shishmaref to Serpentine.
And you kind of planned these so the wind would generally be going the right direction?
It's hard to call it.
Yeah.
Usually the wind is going to go east-west, which is actually really good for going north-south. A beam wind is great.
It's a beam reach, right?
Yep.
That sounds really cool. Have you tried this, Luke?
I've just done a tiny bit of kiting, and it's been on ice skates.
On ice skates, yeah. You were mentioning that you'd done some pretty long backcountry ice skating journeys.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have. You're nodding won't work here on the radio. tell us about some of that, because I think that is like as much fun as you can have is a backcountry ice skating, and you're using like the Nordic skates that have the sort of that you can go over bumps for the most part without tripping the way you would on hockey skates.
Yeah, so the Nordic skates are a normal steel blade and then an aluminum platform, and you can put any binding on the platform.
Uh-huh.
And they're made for Nordic boots, but you can also put downhill ski boots on them, and that's what we've been doing.
Oh, interesting. So warmer?
Warmer, and yeah, more ankle support, and yeah, if you're punching through overflow or if you're on a longer trip, I'd want that extra warmth and extra security of the boot.
So what kind of binding do you use for that?
Like a Dynafit Tech.
Yeah. And it just drills right down the middle of the binding instead of just the side? Because, I mean,
there's a platform on the, so it's like a blade, it's like a T in uh-huh. cross section. So the platform.
But kind of narrower than a downhill ski.
Yeah, but wide enough for a binding.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I've only seen them with the Nordic boots.
That's what they're made for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell us about one of these trips.
I mean, it's kind of a result of, the last several winters have been odd.
Yeah, that
weather-wise.
Was snow. Right.
And so whenever the skiing is no good, it usually means that the skating is excellent. And so the trips have kind of grown out of that. Like, we'll do a lot of ice skating in the fall and then start looking at a trip, and we'll get reports that the snow is really low. So the first extended trip I did on ice skates was from Aniak to Dillingham, and we were able to skate the first 50 miles. And the skates weigh a couple pounds, but it's
50 miles in one day?
No, but 30 miles in the first 7 hours.
Yeah.
We got in there around 1 in the afternoon and covered 30 miles that day.
Uh-huh.
Not very direct miles. We were on a river. So
right.
River miles. But it's really efficient travel. So even with an 80-pound pack, you hardly feel the weight and some cover ground.
I've done it without a pack on a lake when the ice is pretty smooth and you can, like... It's amazing how fast it is and how fun it is.
Yeah.
But rubber ice can be pretty rough.
It can be pretty rough. We get the longest blades possible, and that helps smooth things out a little bit. But you wreck hard too.
Yeah. Do you crash a lot?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
But no injuries?
No injuries. Roman and I skated from Selawik to Kotzebue, which is 100 miles. We were able to skate 80 of it, and he dinged his elbow up pretty bad, not a break,
uh-huh.
but he was definitely favoring it for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah. It'd be smart to wear pads.
It would, but yeah. You're not going to do that,
are you? We're traveling so light,
Well, 80-pound pack doesn't sound all that
light. Well, that was a different trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, but if you'd been able to ski, you might have skied.
Now
that you know about it,
Now because it's so much fun on skates, we'll plan a trip just around the skating. So this winter, Sarah Histan, my girlfriend, and I went from Bethel down to Good News Bay.
Wow.
So that was 150 miles. We went through three villages, Eek, Quinnahock, and Good News Bay. And we were able to skate.
What river? Are you on the Kuskokwim?
You start on the Kuskokwim, and then you basically cut inland to go through the delta. So you're just pond hopping.
Oh, neat.
But we were able to, even the snow machine tracks that connected these villages were skatable this year.
Nothing but ice, yeah.
Yeah. And so we covered 70 miles in the first day.
Wow.
Yeah, just mocking, tailwind. And then less miles each day after that, but it was, I think it was a four-day trip to go 150 miles. It was awesome.
Didn't that feel cool?
It felt really cool.
So what's the welcome that you get in the villages when you show up on ice skates? I mean, that's kind of a new thing for them.
I think in any village when you show up, it's not ice skates or skis or kites. I think it varies a bit, skilled from village to village. Both Sarah and I have done some volunteer work with either Healthy Futures or Nana Nordic or Ski Coup, these programs that get kids on skis.
Yep, we've had them on the show.
Okay, yeah, Lars Flora.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I also grew up in a village, so I do pretty well at walking in and knowing kind of the right way to...
Well, I mean, my experience, which is probably way, way less than yours, is that people are just super curious. Like, where did you come from? Like, what kind of gear are you using? Who are you? And usually really friendly.
Yeah, I think it varies.
Yeah, of course.
Yep, it varies. But in general, if we can get the kids, then mm-hmm. they're psyched, and they want to know what we're doing. And so that's who we will seek out. And then often there's a whole little troop of kids that latches onto us right away when we get into a village. And when you walk in with Skiku or Nana Nordic, the kids are just psyched. I mean, they know why you're there. They've been there for 4 years straight. And,
everybody's excited. It's really fun, and you're doing something really positive for them. Yeah. So do you resupply from villages, or do you bring everything with you?
We didn't on that trip. I guess I never have resupplied in a village.
Yeah.
Just because we're ripping through, and we're only carrying 5 days of food or something. So yeah. We didn't need to.
That sounds really cool.
We got some soda, which you're not supposed to do. Like bad, to try to be role models for the kids, and you go straight to the store and drink a soda pop.
Well, they're probably okay. I don't think you have to feel too guilty about that. It's Outdoor Explorer. We are talking with Luke Mell and Nancy Pfeiffer in front of a live audience at the Taproot. Thank you, live audience. Everybody's being really quiet. Kind of forget they're there for a minute. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our show is about exploring, and it's been really, really fun, and really appreciate you guys being here. I wanted to find out a little bit about how you guys became the people you are, because the stuff you do is not what everybody does. It kind of goes without saying. And Luke, you mentioned growing up in McGrath, so maybe that's a good place to start.
It would be, I don't know if you want to do this, but you could get my mom up here.
maybe we'll get her at the... Maybe we'll get her for the break. Yeah,
she honestly has much better perspective on this than I do.
So what do you think? I mean, what do you think made you into the? What gave you this like desire to do this stuff?
I mean, so I grew up in McGrath, and it's river culture there. And in the winters, it was snow machines and dog sleds to get to the cabin. And in the summer, it's a riverboat. So just sort of growing up in wilderness. And then I came in to Anchorage for high school at Stellar, and got into Stellar had. Backpacking classes, and so that was my introduction to backpacking. And then I studied geology and geophysics in college and grad school, and that was a ticket into the mountains. And I guess the route.
Where did you go to school? At UAF or?
I went Carleton College, Minnesota, and then Santa Barbara, and then MIT. So I bounced around.
Well, I mean, not as much. I mean, like MIT is in like Cambridge, right? So there's no mountains or
no.
That
was horrible, and all of them. Yeah, it was hard to be in all of those
places. You miss home, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
like the Alaska factor has been the constant. And as soon as I was done with the programs and came back, I just really focused on outdoor time.
Yeah. So when did you? I mean, you must have gone step by step from starting out wherever you were at, like doing backpacking trips at Stellar, to doing these like really, really ambitious stuff and winning the Wilderness Classics. Did you ever have like a epiphany? Wow, this is really what I want to do. I want to keep pushing it, or is it just sort of an incremental thing?
I don't know. I think there's a pretty standard learning curve that everybody can relate to in here, whether it's outdoor recreation or otherwise, where you try stuff, you make mistakes, you learn, you laugh. I was super fortunate to have partners in high school that had this incredible mindset just to laugh off all the hardships. And I wouldn't be surprised if that's really similar to your core adventurers too. Like the most important, it's not how strong they are or how good of a navigator they are. These guys, somebody will forget a fly for the tent or the tent completely or something. And if you're able to just shrug that off, it just makes the dynamic work.
Then those are the people you want to be with. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I didn't know that going into it, but by luck of the draw or whatever, those are the guys I learned from. And so I just assumed that was the mentality that you're supposed to have for adventuring.
Yeah. And it's a lot about relationships, isn't it? The building this desire to do this stuff.
It has been for me, and that's a big part of Anchorage. Right? Mm-hmm. We have this awesome community of adventurers. A bunch of the guys I learned from are in here. And then younger friends that maybe are learning things from me. And Anchorage is awesome for this.
Yeah. Has that been true for you too, Nancy, that sort of the relationships created this world for you? Or tell us your story.
I'm from a very different place. I grew up in suburban Denver. I think that who I am and what I love is very innate. We did normal outdoors things that suburban families do when I was growing up, but not to the level that I do now, I think.
Well, no one actually does. Or
I think there are other Alaskans that do that with their kids. But, yeah, I can remember going to summer camp when I was maybe 8 or 10, and 2 weeks in the woods sounded like heaven to me. Mm-hmm. And they dropped me off at my cabin, and there's a squirrel in the treetops, and the squirrel's throwing pine cones, and I'm out the door chasing the squirrel through the woods, and before I know it, before my parents are even out of the parking lot, there's a lost camper alert, and a girl has been lost. And I can remember sitting on my bed just going, I was not lost. Uh-huh. And, you know, at that moment, at whatever age I was, I realized, wow, I am not the same as everyone else. Like,
yeah. So you just had that, something about your makeup just wanted to get out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it was innate. I think I was born with it.
Do you feel like, I mean, obviously, if you couldn't do the stuff you do, you would feel like trapped.
I don't think there would be a place for me if there wasn't somewhere like Alaska.
Huh. Yeah. Well, you did go to Patagonia and like ride across it on a horse, right?
Mm-hmm. So I found another place that filled that. Yeah.
I don't really know anything about Patagonia. Is it like Alaska?
It is. It's like Alaska maybe 100 years ago, which, you know, there's still a culture of people who live on family farms and get between their houses on horseback. And I stumbled upon it as a young Knowles instructor. And I was standing one side of a rain-swollen river with 20 college students under my care, and our food supply was on the other side of the river, and we couldn't get across. And this guy rode up on a horse, and he took one look at us, and it was obvious we had money. We had backpacks and tents and things. And he looks at us, and he says, ¿Por qué no tienes caballos? And he rides across the river. And I'm like, ¿por qué somos estúpidos? And in that moment, I was like, I want to travel this country like that guy.
Yeah, why are you carrying yourself on your back?
Yeah,
right?
There's horses. I want to be, you know, I want to live in this country like the people who live here. And I decided I would buy a horse and ride across Chile. And I think I'd been on a horse 3 times in my life.
Wow. Tell us about the first time that's hardcore, right?
Yeah, there was a 13-year-old girl inside of me that desperately wanted a horse.
Yeah, right.
I was 38. Uh-huh. So, yeah, I came back to Palmer. I took a few horseback riding lessons. I went back to Chile, and I bought a horse, and the people there, as I would show up on different people's farms, they'd teach me the things I needed to know.
Oh, neat. And so you did this all by yourself?
Initially, I did it by myself, and then after I had a few successes under my belt, people would come with me.
A few successes, meaning you do like a trek?
Yeah, so I did it almost 20 years.
Wow, and you said you rode across. I mean, does that mean that you did one long journey? Or
well, initially I was headed north to south. I started the only place I knew down there, which was Coyhaique, and I was headed for the southern end. But the southern Patagonia ice field fills a large chunk of Chile. It runs into the ocean on one side, it runs into a lake on the other, and that lake runs into Patagonia or into Argentina. So there's actually no land route from into the southern tip of Patagonia from where I was. So really no way to get through on a horse. So at that point, I just started exploring horse trails, mm-hmm. all the old horse trails. And I lost my interest in north-south.
Huh, neat. Wow, it's just a sort of a... It gives a sense of this, the possibility, you know, and that this huge world that you can, like, do all of these amazing things that you never thought of. And so it's really inspiring to listen to you guys talk. We've got about 5 minutes left, and something I've enjoyed asking people is sort of what their dreams are, what they would do, you know, if they could choose any trip or if they could go anywhere. And it almost feels like you guys have already done all of your dreams, right? But I mean, think for a minute, like, and I'm sure you've got a list. You've done 20 of these treks, Luke, but you must have a list of things that you still want to try, right?
Yeah, there's a ton I still want to see in Alaska. I mean, uh-huh. I haven't been in the Brooks Range in the summer, and that's like a fourth of the state.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've got a list.
How do you choose what you're going to do? You get together with your friends and just figure out what sounds fun?
Yeah, that's some of it. Somebody will mention that they're looking at going in somewhere, and I'll try to pick up. And then, because I have all these line segments, I'm now kind of in the habit of looking at the ends of the line segments and trying to figure out ways to continue from there.
The line segments are the previous trips that you've done.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can sort of how important is it for you to have sort of the trophy of saying you've done these things as opposed to just the experience?
There's definitely some reward to having completed these segments for me, yeah. And I'd love, I mean, if I had time, I'd love to just zigzag all, have Alaska covered.
Uh-huh.
And I probably won't, but I'm excited to go southeast from Juneau, and I'm excited to go southwest from Iliamna, and there's a chunk in the eastern Alaska Range I haven't seen, and all the brooks, and I haven't been on the Seward Peninsula yet, so I have a huge list.
So a lot of stuff to cover. And you do a lot of photography as you go, and you're posting it on your blog and writing about it. Is that an important part of it, too?
It's become, yeah, more of an important part. Yeah, this part of it is sort of a pro-Alaska, like pro-conservation effort, you know, not formally, but I like for people to see these amazing parts of Alaska and how cool it is to have land that's wild still.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so that's a huge part. Initially, it was kind of, you know, I was watching Roman. Roman always was recording our pack rafting adventures. And
right, Roman
and
Dial.
Roman Dial, yeah. And I kind of envied those mementos. They were a little souvenir. And I've got a pretty bad short-term memory. Like I would do, especially with the classics, I'd look at pictures after a classic and be like, I don't remember any of this.
Oh, yeah.
So making a video of it, I've got a little like dance song and those images, and it kind of triggers some memories. And I can always just make the video of all the highlights so I don't have to think about the bad parts. And
uh-huh.
It's great. So I can look back at something I did 5 years ago, and that'll really trigger
remembering
the landscape for me.
Yeah.
Even hearing the song will help. I'll hear a certain song, and I'll be like, "Oh yeah, that okay."
When I've got this theory that when you're out in a sort of a wilderness setting, and there's nothing man-made around you, it actually is hard to remember. You know, it's hard. Your brain isn't really made for. I feel like it's really hard to sort of remember, like floating down a river. After three or four bends, I mean, it kind of looks this, like it kind of melds together. I mean, you didn't sound like you think that's true, Nancy.
Yeah, that is like I get lost in this. I've lived in and out of Anchorage for years. I get lost here
all right.
All the time. And every tree looks unique, but every road looks really the same.
Yeah, okay. So, Nancy, I answer the same question I asked Luke. What are your dream trips? What are the things that you still want to do after all these journeys you've been on?
I'd like to do some more on the Alaska Peninsula. I'd like to get back out to the Aleutians. Maybe there's some long river trips. I'd like to link together on the Alaska Peninsula. I dream of still going to Greenland.
Uh-huh.
Probably a paddle trip in Greenland.
How do you choose what you're going to do? How does the thought process get you to your next adventure?
Well, now I think I'm pretty wrapped up in, you know, what my husband and I can kind of piece together. So, you know, how can we work around getting, you know, does it need to be a summer chunk of time off? Does it need to be a winter chunk of time off? You know, trying to figure out a way to piece together making a living in with all of it.
And but it sounds like for both of you guys how to do it on basically with very little money. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that allows you to be free, right?
To have the time.
Time and not need too much money to do it. Well, really, I really enjoyed this conversation. I want to thank both of you guys, Luke Mell and Nancy Pfeiffer. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks.
And thank you to our audience here at the Taproot. We've tried this new experiment. I thought it was really fun. My name is Charles Wolforth. Our producer is Eric Bork. Our production assistant is Grace Bojean. She helps line up the guests on our show. Come back with us again for another edition of Outdoor Explorer, and I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.